Both my watch and my phone claim that the clock is about a minute and a half slow. So our subject for today is mind drugs. I hope you enjoyed the chapter. I sort of had fun writing it. And as usual, let me start by asking you what things occurred to you that you want to discuss, what comments, questions, suggestions, new forms of mind drugs that I haven't thought about, or new ways of using them, or arguments for and against, anything that any of you would like to raise before I start talking, because I'm hard to stop. Nobody? So did I persuade you all of the superiority of my new chemically modulated version of marriage? Wouldn't solve all problems. You can, you know, care for somebody a lot and still not get along with them. You could certainly, you know, I think my wife played one of her great talents is she can put up with me. Similarly, I can put up with her. And you could certainly imagine people you would like a lot who you couldn't. So it doesn't solve all marriage problems, but it does seem to me that we all are too willing to take for granted our standard model, so to speak, the sort of the model of romantic love, which is not anything like historically standard. It's sort of not how most marriages, I think, in history have come into existence. And the part point of my story about my conversation with the Indian lady is that it's less obvious that our way is better than their way when there's actually one of them sitting there willing to defend it, and obviously a functional human being who thinks about as well as we do and has a defenses for her views. I don't know if I've quoted you before with regard to the argument against our system. H.L. Mencken has got a book in defense of women, quite a good book, like much of Mencken's writing. And he is defending women, it's just he's defending them on the basis that they're more like he thinks people ought to be, which means cynical, basically. But he has a comment somewhere that women have simple tastes. They take pleasure in the conversation of babes in arms and men in love, which may say something about men in love. So I have four categories in the chapter. One of them is recreation, one is performance, one is personality, and one is control. Did I leave anything out? Is there anything that clearly you have drugs that are medical drugs, but those aren't generally mind drugs? And you could claim that drugs for dealing with mental problems, things like antidepressants, maybe are a fifth category, but you could also say, well, those are changing your personality or improving your performance or something like that. Are there other things that one could imagine future mind drugs being used for that don't fit any of these patterns? All right, so the discussion sort of starts out with the very familiar idea of drugs that give you pleasure, you know, heroin, marijuana, alcohol, chocolate, things like that. And then the question is, start with that. Is there anything wrong with that? All right, lots of such drugs are illegal. Others are legal. Chocolate's legal. Alcohol is legal. Marijuana is illegal. Heroin is illegal, so forth and so on. Are there good reasons why some of these things are illegal? Yep.
I think it kind of went, you gave the example of how like, you lived a happy life and you looked up and what you achieved that all of the physical productive life. And you kind of said you could have gone the other way and just been happy by like chemically increased happiness. And as far as I can tell, like the biggest argument they get for at least keeping drugs illegal is that they don't necessarily lead to like the stereotypically productive.
Is that an argument for keeping it illegal or only an argument against using it? I think it's a distinction that's worth making. There are lots of cases where you would say, well, here's the reason you shouldn't do X, but that may or may not be a reason why you shouldn't be allowed to do it. Yep.
I think the only valid rationale for trying to conscript somebody's behavior that way, to tell them that you can't do drugs, is when the government has a sense of what they would like their poor that they're giving aid to, what they would like to see from that. So when you receive welfare, I think it might be fair for the government to say you can't spend that on heroin and then ask for more welfare.
Why can't you spend it on heroin and not ask for more welfare? That is, suppose the government has decided to give you a certain amount of welfare, that is, that you not only can't spend it on heroin, at least I think it was at one time the case, you couldn't spend it on alcohol either. If you think about things like food stamps. So the question, it's an interesting question. The question is, suppose the government says, well, we've decided here's how much we're willing to give to poor people. Why should they then tell poor people you can spend it on this and that and not something else?
I think there's a sort of societal understanding that, especially with severe habits, like certain drugs that make you willing to starve to death for more drugs, that those types of drugs create a pattern of behavior that doesn't beget productivity. So the people that are...
Well, if you're on welfare, you're probably not being very productive anyway, right? Otherwise, you'd make enough money so you wouldn't need welfare.
Well, theoretically, if society worked better, welfare would be a stepping stone to getting back onto an achievement track so that you can survive, and then you're going to sort of save yourself off of it. Unfortunately, that doesn't work that way. A lot of people stay on welfare, but theoretically.
A statistical pattern, which I think is correct, and which struck me when I discovered a long time ago, if you look at the U.S. poverty rate with a constant definition of poverty, we've got data back to about the end of World War II. And from then until about the point of the war and poverty got going, the poverty rate was going fairly steadily down. From about the point when the war on poverty got fully funded and functioning, the poverty rate has been roughly constant, going up and down with economic conditions. So that suggests that, in fact, it may be worse than you're suggesting, that it may, in fact, be that the system designed to get people out of poverty is keeping them in it. Now, whether that's true, I don't know, because obviously there are, as people like to say, correlation is not causation, and there are lots of other things going on.
Well, there's also some measurement difficulties with poverty rates, because they're measured by the people who are producing the statistics and telling people about them. So if there's an interest for that, you know, body that's collecting that knowledge to say there are poor people, they just adjust the definition of poverty.
Well, the definition of poverty, there are lots of problems with the definition, but one can do statistics on a constant definition. That is, well, probably getting a pretty fair feel. That is, if you're curious, I can describe why the standard definition when originally created was wrong. That is to say, it embodied a logical mistake, but that's a separate issue. Yeah.
Well, what else
I
don't see when you
why? What if somebody would rather, what if you have somebody who says, look, I could use my tax money the way you want. Or I can share one room with three friends, but we can fit four beds into it. And that'll save us a lot of money on rent, assuming we can find a place that'll do it. And then the money left over I want to spend on marijuana or heroin or something that I really enjoy. Why should you object to that?
I don't want my tax money to support anything else. If I wanted to, you know, just for the paying for enjoyment, I spend it on myself. For other people, I just want basic necessities, only basic necessities to help people survive.
I can understand the sentiment. Basic necessity, though, is a considerably harder concept than it sounds. Because go back to my four people in a room. That's certainly possible. The Soviet Union was doing pretty close to that for quite a while. Maybe not, but there's a fair difference between one-bedroom apartment and each room in the apartment has four people in it. But let's go on. I actually give the figure at some point in the chapter of what the minimum cost size is. And that somebody actually calculated. If you say, the least expensive way of getting all the needed nutrients. And it's about $2 a day. And I'm pretty sure that welfare pays more than $2 a day. And so all I'm saying is that there really is there's a fuzzier line than there seems to be between necessities and luxuries. And a lot of what we think of as necessities, it's because we're a rich enough society that we can take it for granted that everybody gets them. But anyway, that's an argument for welfare. But that doesn't cover, what about all the people who aren't on welfare? So suppose we say we're going to abolish the war on drugs, except that using drugs disqualifies you from collecting welfare. Is everybody happy with that one? Anybody have any arguments against it? Are there any good arguments for the war on drugs? It'd be more interesting if there were.
Unless
you're what?
On the rehab program.
I see. This assumes the rehab programs work.
At least the prison tries.
let me see if I can try to sketch out. As it happens, I think that all of the drugs should be legal, but that doesn't mean there are no arguments on the other side. If you people aren't willing to produce them, I have to. Yep?
So maybe we should take it to the government
No, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with what's politically profitable.
Yeah, but that's what it really is.
Look, marijuana is a relative, you can argue without any negative consequences, but it's not a very dangerous drug. And it's not very, yeah, right, and it's not a particularly addictive drug.
But the argument is that it's, I don't know the exact argument, but you can't argue politics. Yeah.
But I don't want to, excuse me, the defending the particular classifications is probably hopeless. And the more interesting question is, could one make good arguments for having some categories of drugs illegal? And it seems to me there are a number of arguments one could make. The easiest one, but one which is hard to apply to actual drugs, is if it causes a form of behavior that injures other people. All right, so you can say, all right, if it were really true that when you smoke marijuana you then go crazy and pull out an axe and start hacking at random people, which is, I think, more or less what Reefer Madness claimed back in, 1920 or something, that would be a legitimate argument against it, right? And maybe there are such drugs. I don't, there are a lot of different things people can take, and I can certainly imagine that people on LSD behave pretty strangely, though I don't know if any of them ever attack other people. So that would be one. Certainly drunks sometimes, drunks do sometimes injure other people. They drive when they shouldn't. The only recreational drug I actually have anything against is alcohol, and the reason is that I have several times gotten into a conversation with somebody, we're arguing about something, and I keep making the point, and he keeps not following, and I get more and more frustrated, and then at some point after 15 minutes of this, I realize the reason is that he's a little bit high. Now, that is really antisocial behavior, right? Yep?
I was in Netherlands for 2 months.
What?
I was in Netherlands, and this was talking to me, and the vegetable has a very funny argument for which you realize marijuana, because people who
it's an interesting argument. But in any case, you could certainly imagine arguments of that sort. And my guess is that even alcohol is not really serious enough for it to be an adequate argument, but it's not an absurd argument. A different argument, and one which is maybe more interesting, has to do with the question of whether people should be free to make their own decisions. So suppose, let me go to the point which I make later in the chapter about thinking of myself as two people, as a short-term sort of pleasure maximizer and a long-term planner. And if you want to demonstrate that, all you have to do is to put a bowl of potato chips in front of me, and the short-term me will keep eating potato chips. And the long-term may, but not necessarily will, push the bowl out of his reach. All right? And that's, I think, true of most people. You have that kind of thing. So what if you say, I'm a benevolent ruler, congressman, president, whatever. I realize people have this problem. I want to make life easy for them. And there are some drugs that give you so much pleasure that if you could take them, you would just take them, even though the better side of you realizes that that's going to subvert your long-term plans, and you're going to lose your job, and your wife's going to divorce you, and all sorts of terrible things will happen. So that's a possible argument. I don't know. Is it a convincing argument?
Can you repeat that again?
Sure. The argument is that it's essentially a paternalist argument. The argument says people will make certain kinds of mistakes that make them worse off by their own values. Many people are lacking in willpower, given the opportunity to have a short-term pleasure, for example, a potato chip or some ice cream or some chocolate or something, they will do it even though, in some sense, if you sort of step back and discuss the matter, they agree that they shouldn't. So I'm going to avoid that, keep that temptation from them by not allowing people to sell drugs that give a lot of pleasure. That seems to me one of the underlying ideas in some of this stuff. It's not an absurd idea. I'm not sure it's a correct idea. But so since you people aren't willing to defend the thing, it means to me I've got it on behalf of all the people who do believe in these things to bring it up. Anybody? Any good counter arguments?
The wrong generation.
It seems to me that one counter argument to that would be to say this assumes a benevolent and competent ruler. And that if the question you ask is not, is there something that government will do that will improve our lives? But if government has certain powers, will it do things that improve our lives? That's a much harder proposition to establish, because going back to the case of marijuana we were discussing a moment ago, I think it is reasonably clear that in that case and many others, the actual policies of government can't be justified by the theoretical argument. It's the same thing on torture, all right? You can set up a hypothetical situation where a terrorist has an atomic bomb in the middle of Manhattan on a timer that will go off in 2 hours, and somehow you've got the terrorist and you know these things. And by torturing him, you can make him tell you where the bomb is and you can then disarm him. Hard to argue against torture in that situation. But you then ask, given a legal system where the law enforcement people are permitted to torture people, is that in fact where it's going to happen? And the answer is no. It could happen in a whole bunch of other and much less defensive cases. Let me take a different case, which is one that at least economists are familiar with, and that's the question of tariffs. All right, a tariff is a tax on imports. And the standard argument for tariffs has been known to be wrong for 200 years, roughly, by economists. There are, however, a number of special arguments for why particular industries, under particular circumstances, it might benefit a country to have a tariff. But if you look at what industries actually have tariffs, they don't fit that pattern. It's sort of the standard one is the so-called infant industry argument. The argument is that you're starting an industry in a country, it isn't developed enough to compete with the foreign providers, but if it's there for a while, people will acquire skills, and one company learns things that help other companies and stuff like that, so we compete. And you say, well, that's not an absurd argument. But it's a little hard to claim that U.S. steel is an infant industry. All right? And you then have plausible economic arguments for why it's the senile industries that will actually get the tariffs, while they'll be the ones where it's politically profitable to impose it. So I think there are arguments for things like the war on drugs, but there's also what I think of as the public choice counter-argument, which is that even though you could imagine cases where a benevolent philosopher king could make you better off by restricting you in this way, there's no good reason to expect that luck. And part of that in this particular case, a point I think I make in the chapter, is that we aren't limited to the existing recreational drugs. Right? Imagine a world, or in America, where there are no legal restrictions on recreational drugs. What's the obvious research program for a sensible drug company? What's the product they want to produce? What will its characteristics be? It'll be really good, but what other characteristics will it have? We've already got recreational drugs. How will it be better than heroin? Better than opium? Better than... It'll be cheap, of course, but what else? It will have no serious side effects. It won't mess up your judgment. Either it won't keep you from driving, or you'll have to be sensible enough not to drive on it. It won't be addictive. Initially, there's some incentive to create addictive drugs, but then your competitor brings out the non-addictive drug, and all the new users go to that instead. So at that point, it seems to be the question, it's still an interesting question, is whether there's a conflict of interest between the drugs, the kinds of characteristics you would like a recreational drug to have, and the kind of characteristics we would like. Is this one of the cases? Sort of the standard argument for government rules is to say the choice that's one argument, there are at least two standard arguments. One of them is people aren't rational. That's the paternalist argument, which is. But a different one, the one that economists like better, is people are rational, all right, but the action that you take that's in your interest isn't always the action that you take that's in our interest. There might be cases so that sort of the current high-profile case, which I also have some problems with, but which is not logically incoherent, is global warming, where if you choose to do things with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the effect of what you do is so tiny that it's no good a reason for you not to do it, and yet we might all be better off if all of us did less of it. That's the argument. right or wrong. It's not an absurd argument. And that's, so those are two different grounds for government doing things. And then what isn't clear to me is whether there are characteristics of recreational drugs which the customer would want, but which somehow are against the interest of the rest of us. And I don't know if you can think of any or not. Let me take an entirely different case. It seems to me one could make an argument along these lines in Italy for banning the pill. After all, Italy is suffering from a falling population. They have, unless they let in lots of immigrants, which is one solution, but they're reluctant to do that for cultural reasons, they have the problem of how you support all the old people who are retired when there are hardly any young people. I exaggerate, but that's the problem. So you could say, look, it's in your private interest, selfish you, to have sex without having babies, but it's in the interest of the Italian nation to keep producing more Italians, and therefore, if we don't have the pills and people still like sex, there will be more babies, and we'll all be better off. So that's not, again, it's not an absurd argument. I'm not sure it's one I'd want to try to push too far. But, so does anybody, I don't know, does anybody have any good examples? I'm not sure I have any good examples. I mean, I'm sort of in a sense arguing against my own side, but that's also more fun and productive anyway. Nobody. All right, you're no help. A good example of a divergence between the self-interest of the individual user and the interest of people in general in his society, assuming for a moment that the issue is not a particular drug, but sort of the best drug that the chemical company can come up with given what people want. It's easy to see that if you have a drug which makes you go crazy, which occasionally makes you go crazy and kill people, if it's pleasant enough, you might choose to have that if the odds aren't too bad. And yet other people wouldn't want you to. But that's all right. You'd rather have the one that doesn't make you go crazy, and no doubt Monsanto can come up with it. Yeah?
So imagine there's a drug that would actually make you feel satisfied with less so that you're more consumer game at 20 hours.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Well, now the entire workforce is out.
Yeah, sure, what's wrong with that?
And there's not, and everybody, I mean, the entire workforce is
yeah, that's right, out. Sure.
And they're not enough new babies anymore because we have...
Wait a minute, the new babies, leave out the new babies. That was my argument. I want to know your workforce argument.
So now we have half the workforce.
Sure, but that's all right. The reason you have half the work being done is that people would rather have those 20 hours of leisure. Look, are you going to tell me I've got to teach two semesters a year?
Yeah, but
right, I'm exactly your example. I choose to be a half-time professor to teach one semester a year because I value that extra semester of leisure more than the money that I could get paid for teaching.
If another country bans that drug, then you are at a competitive disadvantage.
Like, what do you mean by competitive disadvantage? They have more goods, we have more leisure.
No, they have more goods, and they might have more control over markets.
What do you mean control over markets? If they produce more goods, that'll tend to drive down the price of what they sell, not up.
Monopoly.
A lot of countries in the world.
Maybe by going to use the drug, you're satisfied with like 20 hours.
Right.
That's kind of less enough. But because
it doesn't have to be a drug. There are lots of religions that argue for that, right?
Everybody does that. Maybe
you're going to have to ban Buddhism, right?
Right. But maybe at that time it seems like okay, it's a great idea. But then as a overall, the entire nation.
Why would the next generation? We are producing half as much and consuming half as much and taking our income as leisure instead.
Yeah, but then that's not
sustainable. Why is it not sustainable? Look, the people who talk about sustainability will love it. The people who talk about sustainability are worried about our producing too much stuff, right?
Well, I mean, sustainable as in like other.
More what?
They might have more of
they'll be richer than we are. How terrible, how dreadful.
Well, then have
but we'll have more leisure than they do, isn't that wonderful? Why not?
They have all the resources and then you
can't. Wait a minute, what's all this resources business?
Like right now we're happy with the way the price of oil counts, right? And suppose that you can't sustain that, you know, 20-hour work week with everybody in the United States. Which doesn't reach from the country. So you have to deal with other people outside of America. We're not...
We deal with other people outside of America all the time, right?
Yeah,
So why is the fact that we're produced? I don't know what you mean by competitive. There are other people who want things we produce, and we want things they produce, and we'll be buying half as much of the stuff they produce, roughly, as we used to, and we'll be selling half as much of the stuff we produce as we used to. Why is that a problem?
Because it doesn't scale, and people want to realize it.
What do you mean it doesn't scale? I don't understand. We're going to have, as far as fixed resources, we're going to be better off, right? We've got the same amount of land, and we're not using it as intensively, yeah?
Well, I think the one possible way you can get behind the business is you still not working as much as some other countries that come up with a better phone and hit the market. And then you
get to use a better phone.
Yeah, but you have to buy it and use for that. You have to sell something else. But if you're getting beaten in every sphere,
but I don't understand this weaken. You're just producing half as much. Why is that? It seems to me that you're accepting a sort of a military metaphor for economic activity. Big countries aren't automatically richer or happier than little countries. The Swiss do very well for themselves. The Swiss are a lot smaller than we would be at 20 hours a week.
I think because you can have actually two shifts and you can have twice as much employment, so it doesn't mean that you actually have to reduce the amount of productivity.
Well, you would. You're assuming a 50% unemployment rate, which is way above what it's ever been. So,
but the point is, even today, the countries, they don't have so long hours. They are producing countries and they're consuming countries.
I'm not sure I understand. What is a consuming country? How do you get to consume without producing? People just give you charity?
Well, yeah, a lot of countries are being run by IMF and World Bank.
That is to say they are being given charity by other countries.
That's what IMF and World Bank does.
Well,
it's not a charity. It's a drug. But that's net importer and net exporter.
But I don't understand why you would be either a net importer or a net exporter if you produced half as much and consumed half as much. The reason that we are a net importer is because we're borrowing money. Look, imagine for a moment a economy with no capital flows, where the only reason people want dollars is to buy U.S. goods and the only reason Americans want to sell dollars is to buy foreign goods. Put aside getting dollars in order to buy shares of stock in American companies or T-bills or whatever. In that world, you've got a price at which dollars exchange for pounds or francs or euros. What is that price? Like on any other market, the price goes to the point at which quantity supplied equals quantity demanded, at which point we are selling just as many dollars as they are buying. We are selling dollars in order to buy import goods. They are buying dollars in order to buy our export goods. Trade balance. What makes trade not balance? The fact that you have capital flows, so that what is called by non-economists an unfavorable balance of trade is simply a capital inflow. It just means that some of the dollars people are buying are being used to buy T-bills or Apple stock or something instead of to buy goods that are exported. And since that doesn't result in a flow of goods, that ends up with a negative balance of payments. But see, again, the whole idea that there is such a thing as an unfavorable balance of payments is 18th century economics. That's the mercantilist economics which Smith criticized and Ricardo more or less torpedoed. But that would be another long discussion. But anyway, part of the reason going on this is that a different version of your argument, and one which I think is popular but is mostly wrong, is to say that enjoying the drug makes you unproductive. And I say, well, that's fine. But of course, for the most part, being productive shows up in your salary. So if being unproductive means you have less income, that's your problem, not my problem. Now, it's not 100% true because you pay income tax. So therefore, it is true that if you are less productive, I won't be able to collect as many taxes from you or the government won't, and therefore, if the government is spending the money on useful things, that will be something of a cost. And again, that's an argument, but it doesn't strike me as a terribly convincing one, especially because you can easily enough reply, but since I'm working fewer hours, I'm also driving on the roads less and wearing out the roads less. I'm doing less of the things that impose costs the government has to pay for, so what's your problem? Anyway.
I like the idea that I can work less and still be as good off.
not materially as well off. No, that's the whole point. The point is that in a normal market system, you're making a choice, right? You're not perfectly flexible because some employers don't want to hire people 20 hours a week, but if enough employees wanted to work 20 hours a week, it would adjust and people would. As I say, I work one semester out of the year. That's the current deal I've got with the university. I'm happy with it. So anyway, let's... Let me go on, though, to what really goes back to a point that I think you made earlier. And I think of the point in a different context, which we'll come to later, but it's really the same issue. And this is an hypothetical that Robert Nozick, the philosopher, offers for what he calls an experience machine. And the idea is, suppose we had a technology that gave perfect virtual reality, that gave it a completely convincing illusion of doing things. And somehow the guy who's got this machine, experience machine, knows what life you're going to live. I don't know how he does that, but this is a philosophical hypothetical, so we're allowed to cheat like that. He knows what life you're going to live, and he believably tells you, if you plug into my machine, you will get the life you would have lived plus 5%. But it's all going to be an illusion. All right? You will live the same number of years, have the illusion of doing all the same things. You'll forget once you're plugged in that you're plugged in. Before you're plugged in, you get to decide. And in that illusion, you'll have the same number of kids, but the brightest one will end up going to Harvard instead of going to Cornell, some pretty good but not so good school. And you'll have the same job, but you'll get a promotion 6 months earlier and, you know, a few more words of praise from your employer. So you'll have more or less the same life, but in various dimensions a bit better. And the question is, do you accept the deal, if you believe it? Anybody here will accept the deal if they believe it? You will. You're the only one.
Because I know it's my life, current life is very much. It's all about how my brain processes information.
Suppose, let's take a very different one, but it's also sort of interesting. Suppose somebody comes out, somebody who's probably got horns and a tail, comes up and he gives you the following offer. He says, I can arrange for you to have, apparently from an unknown rich uncle, $100,000. In order for you to do this, however, you have to push this button. And this button will result in 100,000 people on the other side of the world dying in pain. But that's all right. As soon as you push the button, you're going to forget. Do you see the similarity? The point I'm making, because it seems to me it's a philosophically interesting point, is all that matters to you what happens inside your head? Because your initial answer seems to imply that it does. And yet, if that's the case...
But what happens to my head is reality for other people. Then my happiness is good on other people's reality of suffering.
But when you get into the machine, the result is that those happy children of yours never exist. The result is the person who would have been your happy husband ends up marrying probably a less satisfactory wife. Involves the other people are being affected. They don't exist. Three happy children don't exist. You don't count that, count non-existence as an effect? Non-existence instead of existence? No, they just never come into existence. I want to get somebody else to argue with their figures. Anybody else want to? No. Because, no, it seems to me it's a philosophically interesting question, which is why Nozick raised it. And my response is I wouldn't touch that machine with a 10-foot pole. But the reason is that it seems to me that before I get in the machine, part of what I want is to have a happy life, but that's not all I want. I also want to have written books that have new and original ideas in them. I also want to have brought into existence happy, productive, intelligent, affectionate people, my children. So there are a bunch of things I want where what I want is not the sensation of doing them, which is what he's giving me. I want the thing itself. And that's part. That's the question. Is it only because, all right, so now we get my happiness drug. This was where we came in a little while ago with his comment. Let us suppose that I have a drug that affects how happy you feel. And I say, I've got a deal which doesn't look quite as pretty as the experience machine, but it's really the same deal. And the deal is that you will do nothing for the rest of your life. You don't get to read, but nothing. Not just, no recreation, you just sort of, sit around or something, we'll feed you something, but we will give you a level of a happiness drug, which will maintain your happiness at least a high level as it would have been in the real life you would have lived. I don't think that's what the question is. Do we? Let's take a vote. How many people think the statement, we just want happiness, or equivalently, what I want is what feeds into my consciousness and nothing else. How many people think that statement is true? Got one brave voter. All right. You might be right. One of the truth makes the majority, as they say. But I disagree, at least. Yeah?
Maybe you feel better off knowing that you sacrificed so much pleasure for the sake of not killing off 10,000 people in the world. So that's, I think you can be like that as well.
That's right. Well, we would have to say that when we offer you your level of pleasure, it's going to include balancing the pleasure you would get from the feeling of virtue of having turned down the devil's offer, right? Yep?
Well, that's the issue with a lot of people in charity or anything just for that feeling. It's not really they're being very selfless. They're actually being very selfish because that is the excess they get.
How would you find out? Suppose somebody said, no, I don't do it because I enjoy doing it. I do it because I think it's a good thing to do. How would you find out whether he's telling the truth or not?
I don't know.
If
he needs to.
Well, but you made a factual claim. It's a claim that fits the way economists think about the world, that we judge your values by your actions. But it doesn't fit the way at least some people describe themselves.
Well, actually, so at least in our belief, the an action is divided into two things. One is the intention, one is your act. For a nuance in the world, we judge the act, and then for God to judge the intention and to reward you on the intention. So no matter how good you do, if your intention wasn't for what God wanted, then you don't get rewarded. You get worldly benefit from your action, but it's not the intention.
But from the standpoint, I don't know in your particular case, but suppose we have two people, and they both did the same things and accomplished the same things. And one of them did them because he liked to be able to tell people at cocktail parties what a good person he was. And he liked to be able to tell himself what a good person he was. And the other person did them even though he didn't enjoy any of those things, but because he thought, I ought to help these poor people do whatever they're doing. Is God going to give the same reward to both of them?
No, because the core principle is your actions are judged by your intention. So for God, your reward, it's intention that matters, not the outcome.
Right. So then if you're... Yes?
It seems kind of like a chicken and egg thing, though, because, if you're making a value judgment about a certain conduct, it's either you think it's great to give to charity, so...
That's the claim, and the question is, clearly there are people who would dispute it, and I don't know if they're right or not. The way economists usually look at it is the way you look at it. One of my short list of economist jokes is that two economists are walking past a car showroom with a beautiful new Porsche sports car in it. And as they walk past, one of them glancing and says, I really want that car. And the other one says, obviously not. Obviously not, because he's walking past the showroom. Right? If he really wanted, he'd be buying the car. Or maybe if he didn't have enough money, he'd go to the lottery and make a bet that gave him a chance of buying the car. That's the economist's usual perspective. But it's clearly not how everybody thinks about it, and I don't know if it's right or not. And the question is, does it make sense to think about people who don't do, who choose to do what they don't want to do, so to speak, who choose to do something because I think it is morally right? You know, if you go back to the religious case, how about if you discover that God doesn't reward people? Imagine that you still believe certain acts are right, but there doesn't have to be, but either God doesn't care or there is no God or for some reason. Does it make a difference? There's a sense, I mean, one of the problems with most of the conventional religions is that the critic can say, well, look, that guy wasn't really virtuous at all. He did it to get into heaven. You know, he could be a selfish, he was unselfish. Sure, he was unselfish. He was unselfish. He wasn't unselfish. He just had a long-term perspective. He realized that suffering in order to help other people would give him an eternity of pleasure in heaven. That's as selfish as you can get.
Sure, but there doesn't have to be any, somebody has to be unselfish to that extent or to any extent to do good.
The question isn't to do good. The question is when do you deserve divine reward, or when should you be admired for doing good? You could imagine someone who did good for entirely bad purposes. It's not bad purposes, but who was the famous Texas oil Hunt, H.L. Hunt? Have I told you the story about H.L. Hunt Playboy interview? H.L. Hunt was a right-wing oil, probably a billionaire, but at least very wealthy oil person from Texas. And he had a chain of right-wing radio stations, among other things. And he was interviewed by Playboy. It's a good interview. And the interviewer took it for granted that he subsidized the stations in order to spread his political views. And he said, oh, no, I don't subsidize them. They make money. If this country is worth saving, it's worth saving at a profit. And it's a great line. I like the line. But there might be a difference in your moral evaluation of somebody who wants to save the country but only if he can do it at a profit versus someone who says saving the country is a good thing and I'll do it even if it's at a loss, so to speak. All right, anyway, going back to where we were. If you are willing to take the position which you are rejecting and I'm accepting and I think other people are accepting that the experience isn't all that matters, if you're willing to say having produced books with new ideas in them is a value independent of the pleasure I get from doing it, having brought up good children is a value independent of the pleasure I get from doing it, just as having killed people in pain is a disvalue independent of your feelings about it, which is the point at which it seems to me you were taking the opposite side of this one, that if you're willing to take that position, then you could say, well, all right, therefore, what's wrong with the drugs is that the drugs give you the real-world equivalent of this, and the drugs result in people doing less valuable but more pleasurable things. And that, it seems to me, is not an absurd claim. Yeah?
I didn't like the concept of, even though you don't remember 100,000 people died,
yeah,
but you still remember.
Yeah. If all that matters is what happens inside your head.
Yes, all that matters is what happens inside your head. It's what happens to you, but what happens to other people.
But in that case, shouldn't it also matter the difference between my having the illusion of having written a book that other people enjoyed and having actually written a book that other people enjoyed? That's happening to them. Yeah, but it won't impose a cost on you.
Yeah, but...
Because you won't know about it. Your memory...
I know about, yep, it, but they do exist.
Yes, but why is that any more real? It may be larger, but why is it any more real than the question of whether I have really given people pleasure by books I've written, or whether I only, as it were, have dreamed that I did?
Okay. It might not be real for you because I don't...
But it doesn't seem to me that these questions can hinge on the size. Suppose you're pushing a button, only one person dies in moderate pain, not agony. You still won't do it, right?
Yeah.
So it isn't the size of the effect, it seems to me, that's driving it. It's the question of whether things matter outside your own head. And I think they do, and I think the Nozick hypothetical is designed to get you thinking about whether they do or not. But, yes, I think so, anyway. All right, let's go on next to performance drugs. And now the question, of course, starts out with what's wrong with steroids. All right, that it seems to be sort of publicly generally agreed that athletes who use steroids are bad people. And the question is, again, is that a defensible position, not a defensible position? Anybody? Yeah.
I mean, it makes sports more entertaining.
Well, that's an interesting question, because that's one of the issues that I raise, because I'm not a sports fan, I don't know. Imagine for a moment that you can either watch a game with good players or with very good players. And in either case, the teams are going to be fairly evenly matched. Do you in fact think you get greater pleasure from the very good players?
Well, I think like the best example is baseball, where steroids did run rampant for like 10 or 20 years. And when I was a kid and I was growing up, I played baseball really like this. The most exciting thing was the home run race between Danny Tilson and Mark McGwire. Both guys were scared, totally on steroids and challenging all the home run records and breaking them. And it was awesome. And it wasn't a matter of like, you know, how they perform relative to like, it just made it a little bit better. Like, we're talking about making them the best of all the time.
But why, but I guess my question then is, Why did you enjoy, that is, suppose the reason they were doing better was a better bat technology, or suppose somebody had made balls that were more elastic. Would you still have gotten the same effect?
Well, possibly, but I also think that baseball is kind of unique because it's a sport where not a lot has changed just in terms of what is going into the game, the tools, the bat, the ball. But
well, suppose we just make the field a little bit smaller so it's easier to hit. I don't know, so it's easier to hit a ball out of the field. Does the fact that there are new records of hitting balls out of the field give you pleasure?
You play a lot of events, but they also play a lot of different stadiums too, so that's something that's harder to control than just steroids. But, I mean, I'm not necessarily really against steroids.
How about if we could somehow forge past records? So we somehow or other can get at the relevant sources of records and lower all the previous records. How do you get more pleasure from the same accomplishments?
I don't think so.
Yep.
One thing that I think is all right about steroids, I think your points are well taken, where it's more exciting when you have only a few players almost on the field because they are noticeably better, and that the contest is better when it's closer. But I think in sports where you have, and I don't necessarily agree with you, by the way, but if everyone were on them, you have limitations on the human body that you can naturally achieve. And at this point, it's not cheating. You're now just using your mind to stretch those limits.
Right.
The human mind is, and so I think that, yes, those records do, in a sense, matter. Like, it does represent some human achievement, like, in the broader sense. I think baseball may not be the greatest.
So it wouldn't work if we had a new sport. Suppose somebody comes up with a new sport that never existed before, so there are no past records. You now don't care whether people are good or very good?
Well, I suppose it is relative to where you were before.
Yeah,
that's interesting. So the answer I thought I would get from some sports fans is it's actually more fun to watch people do things very well. And I can think of examples of that. For example, a long time ago, probably when I was in high school, I read the beginning of The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior, which is a book written by Johnny von Neumann, who is one of the smartest people in the 20th century, I think. And it was really exciting just to watch this very smart person doing things. And it would have been less exciting for somebody who was moderately smart to watch. And I don't know if for athletics, if that's a substantial element of making everybody leave out the records, really, just making everybody better. What I want to compare, sort of speak, is not 2012 to 2000 to 1990. I want to compare the version of 2012 where people are good with the version of 2012 where they're very good. Would you enjoy the games more in the second version?
From where they were good to where they were very good?
If you have the alternatives. You're not going to compare them, but you can imagine that the sport could go on either of two branching lines.
So what you're talking about, though, is essentially this academic thing within sports, right, of keeping all these statistics and keeping track of it.
Doesn't that be a statistics? Look, in future A, we legalize steroids. Future B, we don't.
Right.
You're choosing between those futures. And you are told that in future B, the runners will run a little faster, the batters will hit a little harder, and so forth and so on. Is it going to be more fun to watch the contest as a result?
So the contest itself will probably be about the same for each, right? There will still be close contests.
Right.
There will still be contests that are won by an entire mile.
Right.
But those records relative to the records before, I think, are what make it exciting. Those records are something that, beyond the contest, makes sports appealing and exciting. And relatable, I think, as well.
I mean, there's like an objective value to watching somebody do anything well.
That's the question.
I mean, this is definitely true. With sports, there's an added adversarial aspect to it. And I think when you get to a certain point, like if there were regular athletes and there were like these super athletes that are using even better drugs than the steroids we have now, like that'd be kind of like if I played computer chess and the computer knows how to play chess better than the supercomputer they can. The best
out
there. You know, perfect at chess. I suck. I would lose. It would be no fun. And nobody would enjoy watching that. But if it's closer, like they're saying, where there's actually some, possibility that that person's not that much better, there's still some excitement. There's still a chance.
Yeah, but I guess yes?
Those are the Radiolab episodes about games specifically. And they were talking about the Bobby Fischer game of the century, where you put your Bobby Fischer and play chess against. Some internationally ranked top 10 chess champion. And it was talking about the point in every chess match where it goes off book, where that move has never been made before. So like you move the right pawn forward, that's happened 8 million times, and so on and so forth. It's the one point you reach where it's a unique game, and that's the point that gets exciting for people watching games. And it's the same for other sports where things that happen to them. So it's breaking the record. It's not
well, but I'm not sure if it's. In that case, I'm not sure if it's so much breaking the record, because even if, in a sense, even if you knew that 15 years before someone else had done things that weren't in the book, part of what's going on is that the book represents sort of the depth to which you, the enthusiastic observer, understands the game, and it's neat seeing somebody go beyond that. Incidentally, at an entirely irrelevant tangent. When I first knew the person who now runs the Federalist Society, he was the under-14 chess champion of the U.S. And his brother was the under-21 chess champion of the U.S. And I didn't get very far playing games with him. But that's another long story. Homeschool family, interesting people, strange people. How about the athletic context? I am not going to ask how many of you actually use some prescription drug you're not supposed to use for taking exams or taking the bar exam, but take it for granted that some people do. What's your feeling about it? Yeah?
I think it's pretty awesome. Like, it makes everyone work harder and like focus better. Are you talking about Ritalin?
So you're saying but that's presumably not where you just take, you use it for the exam. You're imagining using it whenever you have that kind of work to do.
You have to. I think everyone has an ADD. No one wants to sit and do something mind-numbingly boring for 12 hours all day. So when you take this magical pill, it makes you okay with it, and you can actually do it and learn it.
Right. So you're taking the case where it is a performance drug being used for ultimately practicing law in your case, right? Yep.
A lot of my friends in college always took Adderall for 3 seconds, and I never did. I don't know why, but I always wondered, why doesn't everyone just take it? And then we'll all just enjoy it better, and then we'll be done faster. I've always wondered that.
It's a good question. I know nothing about Adderall, but my guess is that even if there was no good evidence of bad side effects, there would be some pressure against it. Partly coming out of the bit I quoted with the sleep person, the sort of assumption, that it's unnatural. It's not what we're supposed to do. But the other thing is, you might say, well, we just don't know enough about it, and therefore it may have effects that will take a longer time to discover or something. But yeah, no, that is an issue. And we do have at least one example of a, not exactly a drug, but something like that, which is given that way, namely for strengthening your teeth. fluoride. All right, there are lots of places where they put fluoride in the water supply, and people were upset about that, at least when it was a new idea, and there are probably places where they don't, but there was some evidence that having fluorine in your water resulted in better, healthier teeth and fewer dental problems.
And the increased use of bottled water has made people eat worse.
Huh, that's interesting.
Tap water.
Yes. Yeah, I keep being puzzled by bottled water. I mean, I perfectly well understand bottled Coke Zero. It tastes better than water, but water is water, and why pay for the stuff when it's free?
There's actually a Penn and Teller bullshit episode where they talk about the myth of bottled water and find out that like most bottled water are worse quality than tap water because they're not held in the
container. I don't know if that's true or not. It could be.
How does milk in the bottle not
You know, they also did like a thing where like they had people just taste test, you know, fancy water. And people couldn't tell the difference between tap and regular. Right? Like, they had a difference. It was completely, it was one of those things where you see it and you would just not say that anymore. Because they thought they were like big hipsters drinking fancy water from the Alpine. Okay.
The exam case, exams alone, you can make the argument that it's giving misleading information about your ability, but if you're willing to take this up all the time, then it's not misleading anymore. It's just making you perform better. Yep. Well, willing all the time in the sense that you are all the time willing and choose to do it when there's a particular pressure. Yeah.
But isn't that sincere
for what?
Isn't that sincere for the drug
for the exam? Should you, test the drug? That is, it seems to me there are two different cases.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using the drug only for the exam, then it's not just unfair, but misleading because the people who use the drug will appear relatively better than they are. But if you've got one person who says, I'll take it for the exam, and from now on, any time I'm in a particular situation where I need to focus, I'll take the drug, and another person says, well, I don't approve of drugs, so I won't take it for the exam, and I won't take it in the future, the first person is really going to be productive in certain ways when the second person isn't, so why is that unfair? Why is it any more unfair than some people being willing to work harder, or being smarter, or having better eyesight, or, I mean, there are lots of differences among people, and this is a chosen one, maybe. It seems to me that one possible response, that is one response of which the unsophisticated version I think is very common but wrong, but you might be able to make arguments for the sophisticated version, is to say that it's all competition and competition means that relative is what matters. So if I go back to my earlier argument about sports, if it doesn't matter, if the very good people are no more fun to watch than the good people, then you can say, look, everybody takes it. There are some costs to that. Their health is a little bit worse. And we're getting nothing out of it. And everybody has to take it because if I don't take it, I go down relatively. That's a possible argument. With regard to most activities, my gut reaction is that argument doesn't work because in most activities, how productive you are really matters. If you're a trial lawyer, we could say it doesn't really matter because all it means is that your clients do better and your opponent's clients do worse. But if we imagine that you're designing contracts and you want to design a contract that won't put people in court, and by using Ritalin, you can focus on the problem better and see more potential problems and fix them, then you're providing a real benefit, the argument would be, to people. And since you're providing a real benefit, it is wage as a result of that. Now, here's a possible answer. I had a long exchange with Robert Frank, who's an economist who I think is somewhat interesting, and I disagree with things, who had a New York Times editorial and came out of this. The exchange was on my blog. But he wants to argue the importance of relative status. And he had a book a long time ago, an interesting book, Choosing the Right Pond, where what he is saying is, look, non-economists often talk as if relative is what matters. So people will say, look, the rich have gotten richer. That's a bad thing because now the poor are relatively poorer. And the economists say, why? Who cares about relatively poor? What matters are they absolutely poor? And Robert Frank's answer is, well, look at human behavior. People do care about their relative status. and he has sort of an interesting analysis, part of what I like about his work, is that he said, suppose we include in economics the fact that one of the things people care about is relative status, how does that affect the predictions? And he got some interesting results, that basically, if you have a company which hires a bunch of people doing the same thing, and some are more productive than others, and the standard economic analysis says, if I'm twice as productive, I'll make twice as much money. And Bob Frank says it's not true. If I'm twice as productive, I'll only make 80% more money. Why? Because my making more money makes all the people below me unhappy because of relative status. That's a real cost. It's harder to hire people if they're going to feel like second rate. On the other hand, the guy at the bottom of the ladder, boy, does everybody else feel good because at least I'm doing better than he is. So he gets paid more than his physical production to pay him for the sort of invisible production of you feel. It was a neat argument. I thought. So anyway, but he was trying to generalize that much further. And he wanted to argue that you could justify welfare payments on the grounds that the rich were really getting an invisible benefit from the poor because the rich felt better and the poor were getting an invisible cost from the rich. And the trouble with that, in terms of his own work, is that status is mostly a matter of comparison to people close to you. And therefore, what the rich person really cares about is how rich he is compared to the other rich people, not compared to the people he wouldn't think of comparing himself to at the bottom. But in any case, but you can make arguments along those lines. And the farther you're willing to push that argument, the weaker the argument that says this is just a real improvement in output becomes. So you were saying something?
I was just going to say, with your welfare example, I think that's true, because if it was welfare to the point where everyone was rich, the rich people probably wouldn't feel very good about that.
In fact, what really would happen in that situation is they compete on a different dimension. They'd all be relatively rich, but some of them would not only be rich, they'd be champion ping-pong players, or successful bridge players, or poker players. There are whole worlds. One of the books that I want somebody to write, I know I mentioned this before, is Little Worlds, because the society I live in is made up of a whole lot of little tiny worlds, in each of which people are comparing themselves to each other, so that there's the world of serious bridge players, and there is the world of serious chess players, and there's the world of horse players, and there's the world of Civil War recreationists, and there is the world of legal scholars, all right? Randy Barnett is doing really well today. Why? Because he created some of the arguments that the Supreme Court is taking seriously in the current litigation, and that's a plus for him. So people do care about that, about relative status. On the other hand, it's relative status to a particular group. So it feels as though status is a fixed good. So anytime I get more, you get less. But it isn't really true, because I can get more status by being part of a subgroup within which I am ranking people by characteristic A, while you also happen to be a member of that subgroup, but that's not what's important to you. What's important to you is something else you're in. All right? So I could be, let us say, a law professor who gets status from the Supreme Court citing his articles. You could be another law professor who gets status from being a really good tennis player. My brother-in-law is a computer scientist, teaches at Davis. I presume gets some benefits from that. What he really gets status from is being one of the world's best bridge players. Not something of interest to me. I don't want to do that. So there's a sense in which you can organize a society. I came to this idea when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, because I concluded that Harvard had the perfect social system. Everybody was at the top of his own ladder. And that if you were one of the group of people who put on plays, and there was a, I forget what it's called, something dramatic society, from your standpoint, all that really mattered was, you know, who was what in which play. And the rest of the students were there to be your audience. If you were one of the people really active in Young Republicans or Young Democrats, what really mattered is who got the offices in those positions. And everybody else was just there so that you could get all your friends to come and vote for you once a year when they really weren't very interested in it. Ditto for umpteen other subgroups. And it was the same people. So it wasn't like this set has, no, this big set in which this 5% care about it, and they're the ones at the top of that ladder. And this other one. I think at the time I was discussing Indian Pakistan and Pakistani military affairs with a fellow student who was from Pakistan. And I think I discovered that he was the son of the head of the army or the military minister or something of that sort. And it occurred to me that Harvard at that point was a place where someone like that could feel comfortable. Because everybody else was important too. right? They were each living point in his own dimension. Anyway, it's a digression, but I think maybe an interesting digression. I try to only make interesting digressions. All right, let me go on to the personality one, because that's sort of intriguing. So the question is, suppose we had mind drugs which had predictable personality effects, all right? So might make you more cautious or less cautious, more willing to sacrifice short-term benefits for long-term benefits, or the other way around. And the question is, would you take them? Do you have some idea of the person you would like to be, and if you could modify yourself, would you do it?
I think a big chunk of people here probably do. Every weekend, you pointed out the alcohol as the oldest one, and I think a lot of people take out the alcohol and get drunk because they're a little more social in front of your house.
Although that's a temporary one. Suppose there's a permanent one. I don't know if that's the right one. That is, that is, that has some practical difficulties. There are people who've managed it. So that's interesting. On a given weekend, what percentage of the law students at Santa Clara University are drunk at some point during that weekend? 5%, 50%?
I don't know. Among my friends, like 85%.
That's interesting. I don't think I have ever been drunk enough so that somebody who didn't know me could tell. I've drunk enough so that I could tell, so that I felt different. And I've had enough marijuana so that I could certainly tell, and maybe somebody else could, a very long time ago. But it just doesn't appeal to me at all. And I'm intrigued by how different the world is, so to speak, in lots and lots of ways, for different people doing different things. So that's some evidence that at least in the short term a lot of people do. So suppose you could permanently change your personality. Would you do it? That you get to decide. Assume the sort of the range of what you know of range of personalities. And I'll include the person I mentioned in the chapter, who's actually at least used to be a law professor at Tulane, who I knew when I was in business school at Tulane. It was quite funny, actually, because she and her husband were both well over 6 feet. And I and my wife are about 5'3.5", so four of us walking down the street, it looks like two different species of humans. But it really is true. The story I had in there, when I was at University of Chicago Law School, and they had one of these display tables with some photographs, and there was a photograph of one of the professors getting an award being given by the students, and the student who was handing it to him was this person who I knew much later as a law professor, and she was the person you noticed in the photograph. I mean, I think you would notice even if you didn't know her. That she had this sort of intensely happy kind of expression. So suppose you could do that, would you?
Doesn't the answer depend on like whether the person given that option is unhappy with some part of the personality or?
I'm asking a particular room full of people.
I think I would do it.
No, you would. No. Nobody's gonna do it. None of you're all perfectly happy with your personality in every respect. You're the perfect people. That's what you're worried about. That's a legitimate worry. Yep. People what? And people try to. If you think about, you know, one of the things associated with things like religious conversion. I remember there was the economist used to be here who specialized in economics of religion, and I remember his commenting that he had some analysis of why there were some religions that imposed costs on their members, like keeping kosher and things of that sort. And he had an analysis that suggested that those groups would tend to appeal to lower income populations than less restrictive groups for various particular reasons. And he said the one exception he knew about was the Mormons. That the Mormons fit that pattern, but they do quite well for themselves. Two of the Republican presidential candidates this time were Mormons. But he said the reason is not that they appeal to a different set of people, it's that they're very good at changing people in ways which make them productive and successful. So you could certainly imagine that some people, I think it's probably true of the black Muslims, the Nation of Islam group as well, that they're pretty good at taking people who might otherwise, you know, be drunk and chasing women and so forth, and persuading them to be hardworking and responsible and all the rest of it. So there are approaches people do use to try to change their personality, and I'm just wondering if they could do it to chemically, what the responses would be. Is it still you? How much do you have to change your personality before you no longer exist and it's a different person?
I'd say it's changed up a lot. Just looking at, for example, going from 18 to 25, most people change a tremendous amount. But I say that's the line for
you. This is a thing that philosophers sometimes argue about, whether you should think of a person at different ages as the same person or not.
I mean, your entire body changes, your perceptions change. And some people will even, like, just through, like, psychology and personal training, like, they'll go to, like, those motivational seminars or whatever. They'll, like, try to change aspects of their personality just naturally.
Yes.
Like, over mental retraining as opposed to being chemical. But it doesn't seem like that would be such a huge step. You think the chemicals would be less, like, weird. You know, you could fit in them other people. Or so you would have a certain type of maybe predilection towards certain aspects of personality. I think people would go with that. It would have to be well marketed well.
Let me go on to the control drugs, since we're running out of time, and that's my last one. And I'm curious about a legal question you might know, which is, are there circumstances, suppose I sign a contract, and suppose I can demonstrate at some later point that when I signed that I was drunk. Am I bound by the contract or not? No. Even if I chose to get drunk.
I mean, there was actually a case where these two guys got drunk and made, like, a deal in the bar, and I think the court said that the secret unexpressed intentions of the man, like,
so their feeling was it was a binding contract. Do you like capacity? Does it make any difference whether you got drunk or whether somebody else got you drunk without your knowing it? All right. It's not what I would really think of as dress, but sort of.
Well, I think you could, like, probably coercion unfair.
Because I'm just thinking of sort of the next stage along the lines I'm discussing is to imagine the case where somebody feeds you a drug which makes you credulous or makes you like him, or you're going to have lots of other things of that sort. And let me go on to question I want to think about. I'm not sure we have time to discuss this, whether the voluntary use of control drugs should be illegal. Suppose, take the case as I run into that, where your employer says, look, I don't insist on this, but I'm willing to pay you more if you will take the drug. Suppose it's an honesty drug, right? Suppose we have a drug which makes it impossible for you to lie. Well, that doesn't seem that objectionable, and you know, it'll wear off after a week or two, but he says, look, each week you take that drug, we'll give you a 20% bonus on your salary because we're afraid of people stealing our trade secrets, and if we know you can't lie, then it's easier to make sure you don't do that. Any legal problems? Is it a good thing, a bad thing?
I don't know. I mean, that depends. It's hard to answer. I think that what you said in the book, how we already have crude forms of doing this, like indoctrinating people, in Marines and military, or if you are, when you go to a college, you know, everyone gets all riled up for your school, your college. I mean, it's kind of the same in my mind.
I'm wondering, the reason I was thinking of this case of not lying, the reason that my intuitions are a little different in that case versus the loyalty drug, is that there's some sense and we think of not lying as an improvement. Whereas being loyal to your company, we think of sort of as not as the opposite of an improvement. It makes you sort of less able to reasonably make decisions for yourself. And I'm not sure that you shouldn't be allowed to do it, but somehow it feels more objectionable, as it were, if they're getting you to give up things that benefit you, such as people to be selfish. Yeah.
What is the legal status when you're under the influence of the drug? Are you, because the human is defined as somebody who makes logical choices. Any time you're deprived of that, are you that legal person?
But the counter-argument, in a sense, would be that some ordinary people feel loyal to a company, some ordinary people are honest and won't lie, therefore you've just made yourself into a slightly different ordinary person, and that slightly different ordinary person can still is still free to make choices. Well, according to my watch, we are now at time. It's